The process of adaptation and expansion has continued for me and still does. More recently, I've had to learn how to use social media to expand my reach. I've started 2 companies. I've learned how to start a coaching initiative. And I'm continuing to learn how to connect with people in other countries around the globe. I never want to stop learning. I want to keep enlarging myself, expanding my potential, and improving my craft to my dying day. I want to live out the words of author and pastor Norman Vincent Peale, who said, "Ask the God who made you to keep remaking you." Number 2, stop doing what is expected and start doing more than is expected. We live in a culture that awards trophies to people for simply showing up, regardless of their contribution. Because of that, many people think they are doing well if they just do what is expected of them. I don't believe that helps people reach their potential or expand their capacity. To do that, a person has to do more. Former General Electric CEO Jack Welch calls this getting out of the pile. To distinguish yourself, get noticed, and advance your career, you need to do and be more. You have to rise above average. You can do this by asking more of yourself than others ask, expecting more from yourself than others expect, believing more in yourself than others believe, doing more than others think you should have to do, giving more than others think you should have to give, and helping more than others think you should help. I like the way boxer Jack Johnson described it, going far beyond that call of duty, doing more than others expect. This is what excellence is all about. And it comes from striving, maintaining the highest standards, looking after the smallest detail, and going the extra mile. Excellence means doing your very best, in everything, in every way. Doing more than is expected does more than just separate you from your colleagues by earning you a reputation for performance. It also trains you to develop a habit for excellence, and that compounds over time. Continued excellence expands your capabilities and your potential. Number 3, stop doing important things occasionally and start doing important things daily. Have you ever heard the expression, "Life is a great big canvas and you should throw all the paint on it that you can"? I like the intent and exuberance of those words, but I don't think that advice is very good unless you want a mess. A better thought is to make your life a masterpiece, which requires much thought, a clear idea, and selection when it comes to what paint you put on that canvas. How do you do that? By doing the important things every day. Writer and philosopher Henry David Thoreau wrote, "If one advances confidently in the direction of his dreams and endeavors to live the life which he has imagined, he will meet with success unexpected in common hours. He will pass an invisible boundary. New, universal, and more liberal laws will begin to establish themselves around and within him, and he will live with the license of a higher order of beings." I believe advancing confidently in the direction of one's dreams means doing what is important every day. To do what's not important every day does nothing for you. It merely uses up your time. To do the right thing only occasionally does not lead to consistent growth and the expansion of your life. Both components are necessary. Daily growth leads to personal expansion. Poet Henry Wadsworth Longfellow compared his growth to that of an apple tree. He said, "The purpose of that apple tree is to grow a little new wood each year. That is what I plan to do." He also expressed a similar thought in one of his poems when he wrote, "Not enjoyment and not sorrow is our destined end always, but to live that each tomorrow finds us further than today." If we do what's important every day, that can be true of us. Expanding his capacity and his impact. One of the greatest rewards I receive from writing and speaking is occasionally hearing from someone who has been positively impacted by my work. Recently, I received a letter from Tim Williams, a sergeant who works for the county sheriff's office in Colorado Springs, Colorado. He wrote to tell me about the intentional growth path that he has been taking and how it has expanded his capacity. Tim wrote, "As part of my promotional testing process in 2005, I was required to read the 21 Irrefutable Laws of Leadership. I had told myself that I would first read each of the books I was assigned, then reread each, and finally skim each with a highlighter to obtain possible test questions. My first read of the 21 Laws did not leave me with a favorable opinion. My reread left me feeling better and agreeing with most of it. As I skimmed it, I came to the conclusion that I had been under a leadership rock for the better part of my life. Prior to being a sergeant with the sheriff's office, I had spent 20 years as a sergeant in the U.S. Army Special Forces, so I didn't consider leadership a new concept. Tim went on to say that he continues to read books as part of his growth plan. They have changed his thinking and his actions. As a result, he has continued to advance within the organization. As I was promoted in rank, he wrote, I have also been able to institute several changes within my organization that I credit directly to what I've learned. I have been able to influence others and help many. Tim has adopted two practices as a result of what he learned. The first is that he goes to where his employees are. Tim said, I spent my nights in the jail going from station to station, visiting with the deputies and just talking about anything. I listened, laughed, and just spent time hearing about their families and on some occasions their complaints. As a result, he started connecting with people. The second was writing personal notes to people to let them know that he cares about them and he appreciates their work. He also became very intentional about noting in their evaluations the positive things his employees did, not just their deficiencies. The increase in morale was amazing, said Tim. Tim went on to say, At year's end, I decided to take this one step further and send an email to all those assigned to my shift. I wanted it to be positive and transparent to all. I have made this an annual event, and the results have been fantastic. My shift sick time usage dropped markedly. I've enclosed the first edition of what I call Thanks, I Noticed. Shift 4. As we come to the end of the year, I wanted to take a moment and reflect on the things that you all have done individually to make my life easier as a supervisor. Because of the competitive nature of this profession we share, I want all of you to collectively know what you have done for each other. As this year has passed, in some way, each of you has contributed to the success that we all share. So for all the little things that you may have thought went unnoticed, please let me say, thank you. I noticed. Michael B., for giving up your two planned holidays so that we would have enough people to cover the shift, for volunteering for the paint detail on your days off, for the math project, for taking on the Academy Instructor Challenge, thank you, I noticed. Bruce B., for coming to work in pain, unable to hear when you could have easily called off. For being my straight man in briefings and asking the questions others wanted to. For working through adversity, thank you, I noticed. Rosemary P., for reminding me that I was forgetting, for giving up your slot as part of my grand plan for Lane D., for always looking out for me, thank you, I noticed. Kelly S., for always being willing to change your assignment, for coming in when you could have easily called off, for helping us set the record for the most people ever to change a tire in the middle of the night, thank you, I noticed. John W., for being my first lead deputy as a deputy too, new to the shift and knowing very well you'd take the heat for it. You did it with incredible character. Thank you, I noticed. As a deputy sergeant and a retired Special Forces non-commissioned officer, Tim Williams could have said, I've been a leader for more than 20 years. I know what it is to lead, even when people's lives are on the line. I'm done learning. I will rely on my experience and finish out my career, and people better just do what I say. He could have, but he didn't. Instead, he was open to growth. He decided to continue to be a learner. And for that reason, his life, his influence, and his potential continued to expand. He lives the law of expansion. Growth always increases your capacity. That quality is present in all lifelong learners. And for that reason, their capacity keeps on expanding. It's said that when Pablo Casals was 95 years old, a young reporter asked, "Mr. Casals, you are 95 and the greatest cellist that ever lived. Why do you still practice 6 hours a day?" Mr. Casals' answer was telling. "Because I think I'm making progress." You have the potential to keep making progress until the day you die, if you have the right attitude about growth. You need to believe what Rabbi Samuel M. Silver did. "The greatest of all miracles," he said, "is that we need not be tomorrow what we are today, but we can improve if we make use of the potentials implanted in us by God." Applying the law of expansion to your life. Number one, have you made the mental transition from "I can't" or "can I" to "how can I"? Test yourself. Do some dreaming. Then ask yourself, "If I knew I could not fail, what would I attempt? If I had no limitations, what would I like to do? If finances were not an issue, what would I be doing with my life?" Take time and write your answers to those questions. Now look at your answers. What is your gut-level response to them? Do you look at them and think, "That's far-fetched. This is impossible. How outlandish"? Or do you look at them and think, "How can I do that? What must I do to make this happen? What will I have to trade to make this transition?" If it's the latter, you are mentally ready to expand your capacity. If it's the former, you still have work to do. Spend some time figuring out what's stopping you from believing you can make the changes necessary to expand your life. Number two, give yourself an effectiveness audit so you can be sure you are thinking what works instead of more work. Go back through your calendar and to-do list from the past 4 weeks. By the way, if you aren't using some kind of a system to plan your days, that's the first step you need to take. Try to quantify the amount of time you spent on every action and activity during those 4 weeks. Then think about how much time you believe each activity should have taken, and give yourself an efficiency rating from A+ to F. Now sort all the activities into categories. Where do you see patterns? What's working? What isn't working? What are you doing too much of, either because you're not being efficient enough or because the activity is off purpose? What changes do you need to make? Use the criteria of required, return, or reward to help you make judgments on what you need to change. Number three, do you have a plan and system to make sure you are doing what's important daily? First, define what is essential to you on a daily basis. In my book, Today Matters, I wrote about my daily dozen. I include the list here for you as an idea starter. Choose and display the right attitudes. Determine and act on important priorities. Know and follow healthy guidelines. Communicate with and care for my family. Practice and develop good thinking. Make and keep proper commitments. Earn and properly manage finances. Deepen and live out my faith. Initiate and invest in solid relationships. Plan for and model generosity. Embrace and practice good values. Seek and experience improvements. Once you've created your own list, figure out how you will manage to follow through on each of these priorities every day so you stay on track and continue to expand your potential. Chapter 15, The Law of Contribution. Growing yourself enables you to grow others. If you're not doing something with your life, it doesn't matter how long it is. When I started my growth journey after my conversation with Kirk Campmeyer 40 years ago, I had no idea where it would take me. In the beginning, I only knew that I needed to grow and that I had to be intentional about it. I must confess that in the beginning, my motivation for personal growth was selfish. I wanted to grow so I could be successful. There were goals I wanted to accomplish and milestones I wanted to achieve. But along the way, I made a life-changing discovery. My progress in personal growth also opened the doors for others. It made it possible for me to make a contribution to them. It led us not just to the achievement of success, but to work of significance. Out of what I received in my development, I was also able to give. The confidence I gained from personal growth gave me credibility and made me believe I could start developing others. And in that, I found life's greatest joy and reward. It is my hope that this final chapter will inspire you to be all you can be, so you can help others to be all they can be. You cannot give what you do not have. But if you have worked to learn or earn something, you have the ability to pass it on to others. If you live by the law of contribution, you will have much to give other people, because growing yourself enables you to grow others. Early inspiration. Adding value to others is a high priority in my life. This desire was stirred in me as a teenager when I read about Benjamin Franklin, who once wrote, "I would rather have it said he lived usefully than he died rich." More than just words, it was the way that Franklin lived his life. For example, when he developed what came to be known as the Franklin stove, he could have patented it and made a good income from it. Instead, he decided to share the invention with the world. According to John C. Van Horn of the Library Company of Philadelphia, Franklin's philanthropy was what I call of a collective nature. His sense of benevolence was aiding his fellow human beings and doing good to society. In fact, in one sense, Franklin's philanthropy, his sense of benevolence, was his religion. Doing good to mankind was, in his understanding, divine. Franklin didn't see the world in terms of how much he could make from it. He saw it in terms of how many people he could help. He helped develop the concepts of the lending library and local fire departments. Even his work as a printer reflects his desire to share ideas, not hoard them. One of the things that struck me as a teen was reading that every day, Franklin asked himself in the morning, "What good shall I do today?" And in the evening, "What good have I done today?" That inspired me. It made me realize that I could become more intentional in my ability to help others and keep myself accountable for it on a daily basis. As I have gotten older, that has changed from being merely a good idea to becoming my greatest desire. This became crystal clear to me when I had a heart attack in 1998. In the moments I lay there in pain, not knowing whether I would survive, I wasn't afraid of dying. I had two thoughts. The first was that I wanted to make sure the people closest to me knew how much I loved them. But the second thing I thought about was that I still had a lot I wanted to accomplish. I had contributions I still wanted to make. 51 was too young to die. I learned later that David Ray of the Young Presidents Organization says that most CEOs are less afraid of dying than they are of not making a contribution to the world. So my feelings are evidently not unusual. Good modeling. My desire to help others didn't come only from reading about great leaders such as Benjamin Franklin. It was also inspired by good modeling from my parents. For years, I watched my mother, who was a longtime librarian, become the chief encourager and confidant to many young women at the college where my father served as president. She made a difference in so many of their lives. I also saw it from my father. I watched as he served the people of his congregation when he was a local church pastor. Then I saw him serve and add value to pastors when he worked as a district superintendent. And he continually added value to students and faculty alike when he led the college. And Dad's still helping others. A few years ago, Dad was getting ready to move into a new assisted care living center, and he let me know that he wanted to be the first person to move in when it opened. "That's important, son. I need to be first," he emphasized. Now, it's a Maxwell family trait to want to win at anything and everything, but I suspected that Dad was up to something. "Why do you want to get there first, Dad?" I asked. "You see," he responded, "there will be a lot of old people moving into that facility." Dad was in his late 80s at the time. "And it's going to be foreign to them, and they're going to be scared. I want to be all moved in so I can greet them as they arrive, introduce myself, show them around, and let them know that everything will be all right. When I grow up, I want to be more like my dad." Be a river, not a reservoir. How do you increase your chances of being able to help others and make a significant contribution in your lifetime? Think of yourself as a river instead of a reservoir. Most people who do make personal growth part of their lives do it to add value to themselves. They are like reservoirs that continually take in water, but only to fill themselves up. In contrast, a river flows. Whatever water it receives, it gives away. That's the way we should be as we learn and grow. That requires an abundance mindset, a belief that we will keep on receiving. But as long as you are dedicated to personal growth, you will never experience scarcity and will always have much to give. Recently, Margaret and I heard Gordon MacDonald speak. He challenged us to find someone who could encourage us and then to become an encouragement to others. He asked the following questions. Who mentors you and offers a baseline of wisdom? Who mentors you to aspire to be a better person? Who challenges you to think? Who cheers on your dreams? Who cares enough to rebuke you? Who is merciful when you have failed? Who shares the load in pressurized moments without being asked? Who brings fun and laughter into your life? Who gives you perspective when you become dispirited? Who inspires you to seek faithfully after God? Who loves you unconditionally? These questions are excellent for identifying someone who can encourage us to become our best, but we should also turn them around so we think about taking on a similar role with others. Whom do you mentor? Do you share the load in pressurized moments without being asked? As former President Jimmy Carter said, "I have one life and one chance to make it count for something. My faith demands that I do whatever I can, wherever I am, whenever I can, for as long as I can with whatever I have to try to make a difference." Making the right contribution choices. Giving of your time, expertise, and resources without expecting anything in return is an unselfish act that makes the world a better place. We need more givers. I can't explain why it works this way, but when you focus more on the wants and needs of others, more of your own wants and needs are met. In contrast, when you choose to hoard what you have rather than give, you become the center of your own lonely universe, and you become less content, not more. As a result, you repel both people and potential blessings. You can become a more generous and giving person, even if you already exhibit those qualities. However, to do that, you must be a growing and developing person, and you must be intentional in your efforts to add value to others. Here are 7 suggestions to help you cultivate an attitude of contribution. Number 1, be grateful. People who aren't grateful are not givers. They rarely think about others. They think only of themselves. Their days consist of looking for others to help them, give to them, serve them. And whenever others don't fulfill those expectations, they wonder why. Their selfishness keeps them from sowing, and their ingratitude makes them wonder why they don't reap a harvest. When I was a kid, my dad helped me to understand that everybody depends on and gets help from others. He used to say, "When you were born, you already owed your mother for 9 months of room and board." And after I started to pursue personal growth diligently, the concept of others helping me along the way was reinforced. In 1975, when I went to see Zig Ziglar speak for the first time, he said, "You can get everything in life you want if you help enough people get what they want." Those words stuck with me, and it became obvious to me that many people had helped and still were helping me along the way. Every author who wrote a book that I read, every leader who took the time to teach me, every individual who worked as a volunteer in my church. No one succeeds alone. Many years ago, I came across the following words that express this idea. I don't know who originally wrote them, but I quoted them and tried to live them for 40 years. There is no success without sacrifice. If we succeed without sacrifice, then it is because someone who went before us made the sacrifice. If you sacrifice and don't see success, then someone who follows will reap success from your sacrifice. I am the recipient of many benefits that I do not deserve and did not earn. Someone else paid for them. I am grateful How do I show my gratitude? By daily pouring into others and passing on to them the things that will allow them to run far and achieve beyond what I have done. As you receive, I hope you will do the same. Number 2. Put people first. The older I've gotten, the more I've realized the importance of other people. All the things of this world are temporary. People are what matter. Your career, hobbies, and other interests will die with you. People continue on. What you give to help others builds them up enough that they are able to give to others. It's a cycle that can continue on long after you're dead and gone. Treating others well not only benefits people, it also helps us navigate life better and puts us in a place where we can learn from others. As George Washington Carver observed, how far you go in life depends on your being tender with the young, compassionate with the aged, sympathetic with the striving, and tolerant of the weak and strong. Because someday in life, you will have been all of these. If you are a leader, putting people first is even more important, because your actions impact so many other people. For example, you hear it said in organizations all the time that people are their most appreciable asset, yet many leaders don't behave as if that were true. I should know. As a young leader, I erred in thinking that my vision came first. I believed that my most important responsibility was to get people to buy into me, where I was going, what I was doing, what I was asking. I thought people were supposed to serve me for the sake of the vision. The problem with that kind of attitude is that the line between motivating people and manipulating them is very thin and easy to cross. When a leader attempts to engage people, the first question they ask is not, "Where are you going?" Their first question is, "Do you care for me?" This is true whenever two people want to do something together, not just between leaders and followers. But people especially want to know that they matter to someone leading them and that their leader can be trusted. Once people are satisfied that your motives are right and that you will put them ahead of your own selfish interest, then they are willing to become partners with you in the journey. That's what they desire to be, not merely passive followers or, worse yet, expendable cogs in some sort of machine you're building. The measure of success is not the number of people who serve you, but the number of people you serve. When people are number one in your life, adding value to them becomes natural. You do it as a matter of lifestyle. You add value to people because you value people and you believe they have value. Number 3. Don't let stuff own you. According to my friend Earl Wilson, people can be divided into 3 groups: haves, have-nots, and have not paid for what they have. Unfortunately, more and more people are being added to the 3rd group every day. People are becoming enslaved to the desire to acquire. It's one of the reasons the United States and Europe are in such dire financial straits. They keep borrowing to offset their spending habit. Author Richard Foster writes, "Owning things is an obsession in our culture. If we own it, we feel it will give us more pleasure. The idea is an illusion. Owning things doesn't bring real satisfaction. In general, if you try to feed emotional or spiritual needs with material things, all it does is make you hungrier for more things. It doesn't satisfy. However, if you meet those needs appropriately, then you can be content with or without a lot of possessions. No one should ever become a slave to his stuff. No one should make acquiring more just for the sake of having more his life's work. There is a story in the Bible about a man whose stuff controlled his thinking and his life. His selfishness allowed him not to see the big picture. He was consumed with gathering wealth and felt this would go on forever. However, his life was cut short, and he failed to make deposits in the lives of others. Author John Ortberg writes of him, "He devoted his life to the wrong things. If you were to make a list of his priorities, it would look something like this: harvest large crop, build bigger barns, achieve financial security, eat, drink, be merry, remember not to die." And of course, the last item is the really hard one. Sooner or later, our souls will return to their maker. and the things you have stored up, whose will they be? In 1889, millionaire industrialist Andrew Carnegie wrote an essay called Gospel of Wealth. In it, he said that the life of a wealthy person should have two periods, a time of acquiring wealth and a time of redistributing it. The only way to maintain an attitude of generosity is to make it your habit to give your time, attention, money, and resources. Richard Foster advises, just the very act of letting go of money or some other treasure does something within us. It destroys the demon greed. If you want to be in charge of your heart, don't allow possessions to take charge of you. The question is, do you own your stuff or does your stuff own you? Contributors take the stuff they own and use it as an asset to make this world a better place to live. And they do this regardless of how much or how little they have. Number 4. Don't let people own you. When Margaret and I were newly married and I was starting my career, we had very few resources. Basically, we were scraping to get by. During that time, we became friends with a couple that was financially well off. Every Friday night, Jack and Helen would take us to a fine restaurant and buy our meal. It was the highlight of my week since Margaret and I could not afford to eat there. Over a 2-year period, we received many wonderful benefits of this friendship, and we were very grateful. After 3 years in that position, I got an offer to become the leader of a larger church. It was a tremendous opportunity with great advancement and potential. When I announced that I would be leaving to take it, Jack was not pleased. I'll never forget his words. "John, how can you leave after all that I've done for you?" It was in that moment that I realized Jack was starting to slowly own me. He was keeping score, and I had no idea. It was a wake-up call. That was the day I made a choice. I would always try to give more than I received in relationships, and I would never keep score. From that day forward, I never let one of my leaders pick up the check at a restaurant. I would be on the giving side of life whenever possible. Obviously, I still receive from others. I've already explained that. I am blessed beyond words for what others have done for me. But I didn't want to give away control of my life. It's hard to give yourself away when someone else owns you. I wanted to be able to value people with no strings attached. Giving life should be liberating to yourself and to those you help. Number 5. Define success as sowing, not reaping. Novelist Robert Louis Stevenson said, "I consider the success of my day based on the seeds I sow, not the harvest I reap." That should be the way we judge not only our days, but our entire lives. Unfortunately, most people sow little and expect to reap a lot. Their focus is on payday. Why is that? Obviously, there is an issue of natural selfishness. But I think there is more to it than that. My friend Nabi Saleh, who owns Gloria Jean's Coffee, once told me, "After sowing, there's a period of time when it looks like nothing is happening. All the growth is below the surface. People often don't recognize that, nor have they anticipated or planned for it. They become impatient, and they give up." In his book Halftime, Bob Buford writes about an executive who was seeking advice for how to live his life. Buford writes, "A friend of mine who had been president of a large publishing company once sought out a world-renowned Zen master. After unloading the tremendous business of his life onto the Zen master without provoking much response, he decided to be quiet for a moment. The Zen master began to pour tea into a beautiful oriental teacup until it overflowed the cup and spread across the grass mat toward my friend. Bewildered, my friend asked the Zen master what he was doing. The Zen master replied, 'Your life is like a teacup, flowing over. There's no room for anything new. You need to pour out, not take more in.'" If you are sowing only for quick returns in life, then you will usually be unhappy with the outcome and unable to keep giving and living while waiting. On the other hand, if you sow continually and abundantly, you can be sure that in due season there will be a harvest. Successful people know this and focus on sowing, knowing that reaping will eventually come. The process is automatic. If you live life with the intention of making a difference in others' lives, your life will be full, not empty. I love the way George Washington Carver expressed the idea. He said, "No individual has any right to come into the world and go out of it without leaving behind him distinct and legitimate reasons for having passed through it." That's something we should always keep in mind. Number 6, focus on self-development, not self-fulfillment. One of the more important things my mentor, consultant Fred Smith, taught me was never to focus my life on self-fulfillment. He said self-fulfillment thinks of how something serves me. Self-development thinks of how something helps me to serve others. With self-fulfillment, feeling good is the product. With self-development, feeling good is the byproduct. What's the main difference? The motive. Self-fulfillment means doing what I enjoy most and will receive the most strokes for doing, while self-development means doing what I'm talented and uniquely fit to do, and that becomes my responsibility. Chasing self-fulfillment is a bit like chasing happiness. It's an emotion that cannot be sustained. It relies too much on circumstances. It depends on a person's mood. In contrast, you can develop yourself regardless of how you feel, what circumstances you find yourself in, your financial situation, or people around you. Number 7, keep growing to keep giving. Whenever people stop actively learning and growing, the clock has started ticking down to a time when they will no longer have anything left to give. If you want to keep giving, you have to keep growing. Sometimes people stop learning because they become complacent. They believe they have growth enough, or they want only to make the most of what they already have in terms of skill and knowledge. But when that happens, they start to plateau and then decline. They lose their innovative spirit. They begin to think about being efficient instead of breaking ground. They cut cost instead of investing in growth. Their vision becomes very limited. And instead of playing to win, they start playing not to lose. The second thing that happens to people who stop trying to actively grow is they lose their passion. We all love doing what we are good at, but being good at something requires us to keep our skills sharp. Less skill leads to less enthusiasm and eventually discontent. If we reach this stage, we start looking behind us because that is where our best days are. We think about the good old days, the glory days. At that point, we're only a few short steps from obsolescence. Nobody wants to learn from a has-been. What kind of contribution can we make if we get to this point? I want to give until I've given all I have. To do that, I must keep growing until I can grow no more. A legendary contributor. In December of 2009, a legendary personal growth teacher, writer, and mentor died. His name was Jim Rohn. As a kid, Rohn grew up on a farm in Idaho. After graduating from high school, he went off to college but stayed for only a year. "One year of college," Rohn said, "and I thought I was thoroughly educated." Rohn took a job as a stock clerk at Sears, but he lived from paycheck to paycheck. By age 25, he became discouraged. He hoped to find a better path. A friend of Rohn's invited him to attend a seminar presented by J. Earl Schoaf, a motivational speaker and salesman. The main message? Work harder on yourself than you do on your job. Your income is directly related to your philosophy, not the economy, and for things to change, you must change. Schoaf mentored Rohn for 5 years, encouraging him to develop himself and pursue his dream of creating a better life for himself and his family. By age 31, Rohn was a millionaire. Rohn might have been a success story few people know about, but then his life took an unexpected turn. A friend invited him to speak about his accomplishments at a Rotary Club meeting. Rohn accepted and gave a message that he called "Idaho Farm Boy Makes It to Beverly Hills." It was a hit. Others began to invite him to speak. At first, he spoke to service organizations and to high school and college students, but he soon realized that people were hungry for what he was willing to teach. In 1963, he launched a conference business. During a career developing people that lasted more than 4 decades, Rohn wrote more than 2 dozen books, spoke at more than 6,000 events, and developed around 5 million people. and during that time, he never stopped learning and growing. He observed, "The greatest gift you can give to someone is your own personal development. I used to say, if you will take care of me, I will take care of you. Now I say, I will take care of me for you if you will take care of you for me." One of the greatest measures of Roan's impact is the number of high-profile authors and developers of people who consider him a mentor. At a tribute in his honor, that was held in Anaheim, California on February 6, 2010, guest speakers who honored him included a who's who list of speakers and mentors: Anthony Robbins, Les Brown, Brian Tracy, Chris Weidner, Dennis Waitley, and Darren Hardy. How was Roan able to help so many people grow, and to help so many who became well-known teachers and mentors in their own right? By continually developing himself. He understood that growing yourself enables you to grow others. He lived by the law of contribution. George Bernard Shaw, the writer who won the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1925, understood that the best use of human life is in the service of others. He said, "This is the true joy of life, the being used for a purpose recognized by yourself as a mighty one, the being a force of nature instead of a feverish, selfish little clod of ailments and grievances, complaining that the world will never devote itself to making you happy. I am of the opinion that my life belongs to the whole community, and as long as I live, it is my privilege to do for it whatever I can. I want to be thoroughly used up when I die, for the harder I work, the more I live. I rejoice in life for its own sake. Life is no brief candle to me. It is a sort of splendid torch which I have got hold of for the moment, and I want to make it burn as brightly as possible before handing it on to future generations." If you want to make your life burn brightly for others and future generations, keep growing. Applying the law of contribution to your life. Number one, what is your underlying desire in life? Is it self-fulfillment or self-development? Are your efforts designed to make you feel good or to make you be your best? Is your goal to be successful or to achieve significance? Are you trying to achieve so you can feel happy, or are you trying to put yourself in a place to help others win? These distinctions may seem subtle, but they really make a difference. Trying to feel fulfilled is a never-ending restlessness because you will never be completely satisfied with your progress. Trying to develop yourself is a never-ending journey and will always inspire you because every bit of progress is a victory, yet there will always be new challenges to excite and inspire you. Number two, make sure that no person owns you. Make a list of the key people in your life. Now think about each relationship and determine if you are mostly the giver, you are mostly the taker, or the relationship is even. If you are primarily the taker, then you need to make adjustments so the other person doesn't have power over you. How do you do that? By making the effort to outgive the people in your life without keeping score. You can do this not only with your family and friends, but even with your employer. Make an effort to give more work than your organization pays for. Not only will the people you work for and with value you, but you will add value to them. And if you have an opportunity to move on to bigger and better things, you will be able to do so knowing that you have always given your best. Number three, I have one final application exercise for you in this audiobook, and that is to put people first in your life. Write down your top 3 to 7 goals and dreams. Now write down the names of the most important people in your life. Be honest with yourself. Which comes first, the people or your goals and dreams? If you are like I was early in my career, my agenda was first. Fortunately, I realized very early in my marriage that I needed to put Margaret first. That opened the door for me to be less selfish in other areas of my life. Then when my children came along, I had to put them ahead of many other things. The longer I live, the more important people have become to me. At this stage of life, nearly everything I do, even related to personal growth, is motivated by the desire to help others. Make the decision to put others ahead of your own agenda. Put your family ahead of your own agenda. Put the development of people at the workplace ahead of your own advancement. Serve others instead of yourself. Commit to it, and then invite others in your life to hold you accountable. And remember, sometimes the seeds you sow take a long time to grow, but you will always see a harvest.
This has been a Hachette audio production of The 15 Invaluable Laws of Growth. Live them and reach your potential. Written and read by John C. Maxwell. Produced by John Clem. Directed by Bob Walter. Recorded by Saturn Sound Studios. Post-production by Gabino Reyes. The 15 Invaluable Laws of Growth is also available in print and as an ebook from Center Street, a division of Hachette Book Group. Text copyright 2012 by John C. Maxwell. Audio production copyright and published 2012 by Hachette Audio. All rights reserved. In accordance with the U.S. Copyright Act of 1976, the duplicating, uploading, and electronic sharing of any part of this audiobook, without the permission of the publisher, is unlawful piracy and theft of the author's intellectual property. If you would like to use material from the audiobook, other than for review purposes, prior written permission must be obtained by contacting the publisher at permissions@hbgusa.com. Thank you for your support of the author's rights.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.